So where are kings and emperors now? That old, that went and came. You know, I was thinking that when Brother John was sharing here, that's a tremendous message, very practical message. And especially I was struck with the one thing there that he said about the abundance of the heart is what comes out. You know, I'm one of those that tends to think these are just isolated incidents when I say something I shouldn't. But I acknowledge that what he said is true, and it's a matter of the heart. And so I just appreciate that, and I was just thinking, I was just sitting there, that it's possible in a teaching like that, that you felt convicted. And I would certainly say that, respond to that conviction if there's anything you'd like to just try to deal with in your life, because now we're going to be talking about church history, which is an excellent place for you to allow that conviction to die. And so we just like to encourage you if there's something, and I just confess that I found myself, you know, there was a time in my life, and I'm not free of that yet, of that frowardness. You know, that thing, especially with some people, that no matter how true it was they said, I wanted to oppose it. Okay, as I said yesterday, we're trying to give a basic knowledge. And by the way, if you just want the basic knowledge of the history, there's a very good book that I think, I haven't read it completely, I'm still going through it, but there's a book that can do that for you if you just want a basic knowledge that's more detailed than what I'm able to give you here this week, but still doesn't go into all the details of what happened. And it's a book by Keith Crider. I'm using some of what he wrote in there, called Church History. You can get it from CLE, and it was designed for that very thing. If you want more scholarly books, you'll have to go elsewhere, but that is a very very good book for just a basic knowledge. Now, Brother John also said that, and this struck me, I never thought of this before, but he said when God spoke, He created something. And when we speak, we create something. We create an impression, for one thing, in your mind, but I spoke yesterday and created a myth. And I don't know how many of you caught that. Some of you did, because some of you mentioned it to me. But I said something that was not true. I thought it was true, but it's not true. And when I was preparing for that first message, I thought the apostles' lives were some that recorded in the scriptures I knew fairly well. I didn't always bother doing as much checking. I should have done that and didn't. But I got Philip the Evangelist and Philip the Apostle thrown together in the same man. And so, Philip the Apostle, everything I said was true, except the fact that it wasn't one man. Philip the Apostle spent most of his teaching, his lot, when they divided up the empire, his lot was to go up through Syria and then to Asia there, in Turkey, I think. And then he did wind up getting martyred there in Phrygia with his head tied to a pillar and stoned to death. That was Philip the Apostle. Philip the Evangelist, I believe, according to Acts, was the one that went to Samaria and then down to the eunuch and then wound up in Caesarea. And if you read in Acts 21, you'll read that, where they stayed at the house of Philip the Evangelist there at Caesarea, I believe. But that was a mistake I made by not taking the time to make sure I had my facts straight. Okay, from here on, we're going to be dealing a lot with the history after that. And I just, John D. mentioned something up here about the shooting the messenger. I'm just saying, don't shoot the messenger. Because these are things that I'm learning from other people. So if they're true or not true, you're going to have to argue with them, not me. I'm simply going to try to give you my understanding of what they recorded as happening in history. So we ended yesterday with the apostles, except for the apostle John, who lived, they according to various sources, lived to, I think, It was late. I don't know when it was, but he was a very old man. Was it 96 or somewhere? But for most of the others, I think all of the others, I looked and all the other apostles would have not been living for very long, if at all, after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And so we got to that point. But I wanted to start with making a little comment about the Roman Empire. I had yesterday alluded to this. But at the time of Christ, the empire covered vast distances. And I'll give you some countries that were included in that, countries of today. The empire covered North Africa, along the southern part of the Mediterranean there, and some ways south of there, and Egypt. It included the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, which was Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, parts of Saudi Arabia and Iraq, and then all of Turkey, Greece, Romania, Serbia, Albania, Hungary, Austria, Italy, Switzerland, Germany, France, Belgium, Spain, Portugal, and Britain. That would have been all part of the Roman Empire, or at least parts of those countries as we know them now. So that was a vast empire that the Romans controlled. It was a very stable empire. And for the most part, they had the Pax Romana, which lasted till 180. And there was no serious threat to their sovereignty. But as they conquered lands, as they went and they added to their empire, as they did that, what they did, and I mentioned this yesterday a little bit, is that they would not... So, let's just say, for instance, they were going to wherever. They were going to the north or the west, and they were conquering a people that had other gods than they did. And their practice was not to forbid them to worship their gods. They just subdued them, brought them under their control, but they did not forbid them to worship those gods. They just asked or required that they would also add to their worship, I think, a sacrifice to the emperor. I'm not sure if they made them worship Rome's gods. Whatever the case, there was a freedom to keep your own gods there. That was their practice. The other thing that happened was, and I'm not sure, I did not research this, maybe some of you would know this, but there was a way that you could buy your Roman citizenship, and it seems like Paul at least lived in a place where you were automatically a Roman citizen there in Tarsus. And those that had Roman citizenship had privileges others did not. I give an example of that. When Rome, under Nero, the persecution under Nero there in Rome, when that persecution was going on in AD 60 or thereabouts, Paul and Peter were both killed in that persecution. But Paul was beheaded and Peter was crucified. That's the difference between being a citizen and not being a citizen. If you're a citizen, you get a merciful, quick death. If you're not, you get crucified. The other thing that they did was they built roads and infrastructures wherever they conquered. They improved and they built infrastructure and roads. And somebody told me, I don't know if I ever read this, I may have read this somewhere, that in all major roads that went to Rome, they had a signpost saying how far it was to Rome. They had a very good system of mileage or whatever they used back then. I don't know if it was a mile or what it was. But they measured distances very accurately. And they had them well marked. And those roads, I understand that Romans built, were still being used into the 15 and 1600s. And may still be remains of them to this day. People in the kingdom or in the empire spoke Latin, or in Rome spoke Latin, and it was probably the legal language, but very likely more people spoke Greek than Latin, especially in the eastern part. And then in the western part of it, it was a mixture. And a lot of those languages we now know, such as Spanish, French, well, I'm not sure about French, but there's a lot of those, I think, that did come from Latin. Romanian came from Latin. So you can imagine if you have a country somewhat like the United States with a rule of law that has good infrastructure, why it was so easy for Christianity to spread. And already having that basis, the difference between United States and Rome was, the Roman Empire was, that they already had the concept of God. They already, that here we have a serious lack of the fear of God. And there was a tremendous fear of God. There's tremendous fear of what the God would do if you didn't sacrifice to Him. And so that was there already. And so they were just preaching about the one true God as they went. So now the initial persecution of the church came from Jewish rulers, including Saul, as we all well know. Now, he was one of the most zealous persecutors, it seems, there in the book of Acts. And that came from the Jewish rulers, the Sanhedrin, the Pharisees, the Sadducees. But it wasn't long until the Romans themselves began to have a growing concern about followers of the way. And what happened was, the Jews had been a very unhandy people for the Romans to deal with. Because they did not mind at all to give their lives for their cause. They did not, the Romans found them very difficult to deal with, because what are you going to do if every man and woman there would rather die than obey? And so what had happened, because they refused to include emperor worship and some of those things, sacrificing to the Roman gods, what the Jews had, or the Romans had finally done was say, okay, you all are allowed to have your religion. We're not going to make you obey and worship our gods. You're allowed to have your religion. And they didn't have much. There was a proselyte now and then. There weren't that many of them. They weren't concerned about them taking over the government. As a matter of fact, they were pretty exclusive. They didn't welcome others coming in unless they met a lot of requirements that the Romans weren't that eager to meet. And so basically what they had here was they just left them to themselves in one way. They had to pay tribute and all that. They left them to themselves to worship as they wanted to. They didn't see them as a threat. And initially when we had the Christians coming out of the Jewish church, they thought it was just a branch of the same thing. And the Romans didn't, to them it didn't seem like a threat at the first. But when they began to be concerned was when the Jews came to them and said, look, these people are not, they're not part of us. I don't know what all they said, but basically they just let them know that they're not part of us. We don't claim them. And the other thing that happened was these people were going everywhere converting people. And they were set to take over the whole kingdom because people were just turning to this way. And we'll have some numbers here later on about how many Christians there were, at least in name, in those first centuries there. And so Rome began to be increasingly concerned about these Christians. They seemed to be everywhere. And they seemed to be making great inroads in converting people away from the Roman gods towards this other god. And that in the Romans' minds meant that their gods are going to get angry. And therefore, they're going to start losing in battle. The Romans initially called them, before any persecution broke out there from the authorities, they called them atheists. Because if you didn't call them atheists, it meant they worshipped a god. And they couldn't acknowledge that. They didn't want to acknowledge that. So they called them atheists. They called them cannibals because they kept... man-eaters, they said, because they would talk about the body of Christ. And they had their communion there, where they partook of the body of Christ. And it wasn't not the Eucharistic model where we have this thing turned into physical, but just the speech they had. They also accused them of sexual immorality because they called everyone brother and sister. And they talked about love feasts, which was their supper. And so they accused him of that. And so these people, these Christians, had a people look down on them. They despised them. Now, I'm sure there were exceptions to that in some places. There were people that knew them as very upright. But then there was another thing that happened that caused a disturbance in Rome. If you read in Acts 18, it talks about Claudius made all the Romans leave. All the Jews leave Rome. And there's several opinions why that was. Suetonius, or whatever his name was, I believe, Suetonius, he was an early Roman historian. He said that the Jews were continually making disturbances at the instigation of Crestus. And so Claudius expelled them from Rome. Well, in early centuries, Latin speakers used Crestus as a name for Christ. And so some believe the reason Claudius expelled the Jews was because the Jews, the Orthodox Jews, or the Mosaic Jews, were persecuting the Christians and making disturbance. So whether that is true or not, I don't know. But whatever case, the Jews were expelled, and the Christians had a bad name. So we're moving up towards some more action being taken. But before that, before we get to the persecutions, I want to talk a little bit about the false teaching. There was something else that the church faced very early on, very quickly. Paul said there, I believe it was, maybe I should look this up too. I'm going too much by memory, but I think Paul, speaking to the elders there at Miletus, said that, if I have my names right there, he said that, I know that after my departure, grievous wolves shall come in among you, not sparing the flock. Something like that, he said, I believe. And so there were false teachers there. There was things going on. The first one, obviously, was that the Gentile believers need to be circumcised. That was the first false teaching. And that kept roiling, causing turmoil in the church for quite a long time. That whole thing. If you're reading Galatians there, I believe it is, where Paul talks about Peter and them separating themselves. You can see that thing was still at work there. That can be more understandable with where they were raised at. Another false teaching was called, and I don't know if I can say this right, antinomianism or something like that. I don't know if our word nominal comes from that or not. But that taught, and it was fairly early on, that freedom from the law meant freedom to sin. And I think in Romans 6 it says, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid. I believe Paul was addressing that false teaching there. Because there seemed to have been a belief that we're not under the law anymore. I think that has some echoes. Maybe in our modern times we've heard some echoes of that. But we're not under the law anymore, so now we're free to sin. He said, brother, you've been called unto liberty, only use not liberty for an occasion to the flesh. Gnosticism was something else that showed up very early. And it was a marriage of Greek philosophy and Christian teaching, it seemed. Now, Gnosticism wasn't confined to one group. It wasn't like when you said a Gnostic that it described the entire thing. It was various groups, but they had some things that they somewhat held in common. Some similar beliefs. Much of their thinking was influenced by philosophers such as Socrates and Plato. And Christians found some of these ideas very tempting. And I'll just say, especially in interpreting Bible in allegorical ways. You know, we're always looking for that hidden meaning. There's always that, we always have that sense of wanting to find something there that's maybe not there. But that was one thing they did. And there was a man once I knew well. And I don't know if he's still living or not. But he was not quite, we would say, normal in a way. He was very zealous for God, and yet he was unbalanced. But it wouldn't matter, like this clock right here says 10:17. He would take those numbers and come up with some spiritual meaning behind those numbers. That's what he did. He looked at my license plate, and he said, he had the letters and number combination. He'd come up with some spiritual meaning of that. And so that's what he did. Well, this is somewhat, the Gnostics were somewhat like that. So, like for instance, they took the age of Jesus when he was baptized, which they considered was 30. And then they took the hours that Jesus mentions in his parable in Matthew 20, the first, third, sixth, ninth, and 11th hour. And they put all these together, and that adds up to 30. And they came up with the idea that there's 30 gods in the Godhead. So that was their way of thinking. That was one of the things they did. They were also a dualistic religion, which means that believed in more than one God. And they believed that all matter is evil. They believed that Everything is evil. Everything is evil. So they believe that the true God, the holy God, wherever he is, whoever he is, through a series of emanations or, I don't know, could you say lightning flashes, I don't know what, charges, electrical impulses, created other gods, and those in turn created other gods. And finally we get to a God, the God of the Old Testament, that was corrupted enough that he could create matter. That was another central belief that they had. He could not be a holy God because he created matter. That was something they held to. Now, and the good God sent one of the lesser gods, which was Jesus, into the world, and he brought the saving gnosis or gnosis, knowledge, to men, to some of mankind. But since matter is evil, Jesus didn't really have an earthly body. He came into an earthly body and lived there at the time of his baptism. He came in, and before the crucifixion, he left again. So it was a dualistic nature. It was Jesus Christ inside this body, but not really human. And so that was another thing that the groups held in common there. And I haven't done, this is pretty basic. I didn't really dig into all their beliefs. I didn't think it was necessary. But this gives you some idea why the Apostle John in 1 John 4 said this. He said, "Hereby know ye the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh and is of God, and every spirit that is of God, and every spirit that confesses not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God." And you see why he put that emphasis there, because they already had this false teaching that was teaching otherwise, that Jesus really didn't come in the flesh. And he says, "This is the spirit of Antichrist, whereof ye have heard that he should come, and even now already is it in the world." Paul warns against science falsely so called. That was probably another warning against Gnosticism. Then that produced something in their lives that was very unbalanced. They lived in extreme self-denial. They refused to marry because they said, if we marry, we're going to have children, and then those children are going to be spiritual beings trapped in an evil body and matter. And so they refused to marry, and they barely ate. I think they ate once a week or twice a week, some of them, because they considered all matter evil. On the other side, others lived to the fullest extent. They said, if the spiritual in here and the physical is two separate things, we can sin all we want to in the body. And so they just did whatever they wanted to and didn't figure it would affect the spiritual at all. So there were many beliefs like that. But we're going to leave them and move on. We don't need to look at all those. And about 135 AD, there was another heresy appeared. It was called Marcionism or something like that. They believed the Old Testament God was separate from and inferior to the God that was the Father of Jesus. And he taught, this Marcion, he taught rigid self-denial in food and drink. He forbade marriages and required married people to separate. So if you're part of his church. And we'll give a little bit of context here in a little bit of why this was appealing to the churches. And in the 150s, there was this Montanism that gained some traction. And Montanus had, according to history, had convinced two women that he convinced that they were prophetess. And he convinced them to leave their husbands and travel with him. And that he promoted the idea that the Holy Spirit spoke through them. And they went to ecstasies and all kinds of things and prophesied and said these things. This was another heresy that the early church faced. They said the New Jerusalem would soon appear and people should gather at a certain place and wait for it. Get rid of your businesses, come here. And they felt they had the power to forgive sins. Well, the reason that many in the church were attracted to these is because of that self-denial, that ascetic living, because the church as a whole had been drifting away from that. And so that's why some of these were attracted. There's another reason why, I'll just give a little short story here about this one. This was documented story about this girl named Thecla. And she was, I don't know how old she was, but she was engaged to be married, so I'm guessing she was in her teens somewhere. But she heard Paul preaching on chastity. And she renounced her engagement and followed Paul. and her mother and fiancé drug her before the governor, and he condemned her to be burned, but they tried to burn her in a hailstone, put the fire out, and anyway, there's a longer story. She was martyred in the end, but it had such an appeal to people of that time because of the excesses of sin they saw in the empire. Marriage meant nothing more than a legal contract then in the Roman Empire. You could commit as much adultery as you want. There was no crime in that. As a matter of fact, in some places it was probably encouraged. And I think it was some of these things that drove people towards more of these ascetic groups. There was another reason, and I wasn't going to get into that just yet. I need to figure out. Okay, well, we'll go on here a little bit. So after Jerusalem fell in 70 AD, Antioch became the center of the church. Now, you all, most of you know where Antioch is. It's that little thumb that sticks down the bottom end of Turkey. So you have the Mediterranean on one side and the Syria on the other side. And I remember being there. I was there a few different times, and I remember thinking, what if through the night they decide to straighten that northern border of Syria out and I wake up in Syria in the middle of a civil war? I didn't find that appealing. But it's that little thumb that sticks down there. And this is where the church then kind of made its new headquarters. And under some notable bishops, of whom Ignatius was one. A lot of you know who Ignatius was. We have 8 letters that he wrote to the various churches as he was on his way to being killed. But he was one of those, and the church spread. It had tremendous influence in Syria at that time. By the end of the 4th century, which would be by the end of the 300s, Antioch had 500,000 people in it, and half of those identified as Christians. So you had 500,000 people in Antioch, and 250,000 of those were considered Christians. So that was a tremendous spread of Christianity. Meanwhile, to the west, Rome had a rapidly expanding church as well. And by the year 250, more than 30,000 people called themselves Christians in Rome. So again, Christianity was just booming. I mean, it was the latest, greatest, and it was really making a difference. And I believe a lot of those were probably sincere and devout. I don't know, but we'll hear in a little bit. We'll look at some things that weren't going all that well. But from the very beginning, Rome considered itself the leader of the Christian world because of the fact that both Peter and Paul had been there as bishops of the church there and had both been martyred there. And so they considered themselves to be the leaders of the Christian world, of the Christian church. But even though they did, there were other cities that had large, there were many cities that had large numbers of Christians. And there were two, especially in the northern part of Africa. So, or Alexandria would have been in Egypt, and then Carthage would have been in, I believe, would probably have been considered Cyrene. I think it's present-day Tunisia, maybe, if I'm not wrong. They had very large Christian populations there. And meanwhile, when all this was happening, I don't want to lose sight of this, but out west, in the western part, towards the Europe, there was still tremendous evangelizing going on in those areas as well, over towards Spain, France, on up. There was much evangelizing going on there. But we might find it surprising today to understand why this false religion had such an appeal to those people, besides the self-denial. Why didn't they just understand that this is not the Word of God? This is not the way the Word of God reads. So I think it's good to be reminded that they didn't have a New Testament. They had the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, but they did not have the New Testament. There was no such thing. Well, it was there, but it wasn't it hadn't been compiled in a book yet, and nobody had figured out how to do that yet. And so there were various letters circulating. And I just say, if you had 2 letters here that were sent to your church by 2 different people, how would you decide which one was the one to follow if they said different things? So it was tremendous. So your reliance had to be on where you considered the most authoritative source. And so obviously the apostles' letters were held up because they had been close to Jesus. But there were other letters. And then you take Ignatius. I just spoke to him just a minute ago about Ignatius. And he was martyred for the faith. He was a bishop, I believe, in Antioch. I said he was in Antioch. And he was a bishop there. And if you read his letters, and I have, he's a very godly man. He calls you to a high standard of holy living. There was nothing wrong with his letters. But there was something he did that the apostles never did. And that was that he taught that the bishop of the church, you should regard him as Jesus Christ. And see, already there, he was veering away from what had been taught. And he, I believe, did it in all honesty of his heart. I don't know. That was thousands of years ago. But it just shows that if you have these two letters and you have this from Ignatius, which is a very highly esteemed man, especially if he's going to his death and he writes this to you, you have this. And so what happened out of that, and it wasn't just this, the church had been moving towards this anyway, but what happened with that was that he placed in their minds the idea of a hierarchy in the church. So you have the bishop up here, and you have the presbyters, deacons, and then the laity, which is something that Jesus clearly taught against. And then the idea was that not that far removed, that if you have a bishop in each church who has this kind of authority, now to have a bishop that's over all the churches just made perfect sense, which was the Pope. So I'm just saying that these things kind of pointed that direction. Well, the leaders of the church realized early on, and one thing that actually accelerated the compilation, the getting together, the proving of the New Testament canon, was these false teachings. Because they realized early on that we're going to have to get something that is authorized, basically, that people can trust as the truth of God's Word to combat these false religions. And so they set about doing that. And I don't know how early they started doing that, but they realized they needed something, and they started doing that. Now, we don't have to decide. To us, if you would say we want to add another book to the New Testament, you say, I mean, it's crazy. We have the New Testament. We don't need another book. Or take one away, for example. Which one would you take away? Would you take away the pistol straw that Martin Luther spoke about that Brother John's preaching out of? Or what would you do? Would you, like Benjamin Franklin, take everything out that can't be proven by science? What would you do? But they had some guidelines they went by to decide what to put in there. And I don't think this is a full list. I've heard various other ones. I think it's Paul Shirk, I think his name is. If you ever get a chance to listen to the series he did on the compiling of the scriptures, it's a very, very worthwhile thing to listen to. It's a tremendous job there. But some of the guidelines were that it had to be written by to be accepted in the New Testament, it had to be written by an apostle or a close associate of one. One that worked with, like, say, John Mark, who worked with Peter, or Luke, that was with them all the time. Another thing that they went by, did the churches in general accept it as truth? So did all the churches agree that this was the truth by what they understood from apostles? Were its contents edifying? And I'm going to make a little bit of an elaboration on this because I read somewhere else that what that meant was, were its contents edifying? I can't remember where I read this, but it said that one way they proved whether it should be in the scriptures, that if people read it and obeyed it, it changed lives. So if you read it and you did what it said, that you were doers and not hearers, and it changed your life, that was, otherworldly, but was against the flesh, then they believed that it was inspired by the Holy Spirit. So some of the guidelines. By 200, the churches had agreed on most of the writings. There were a few that they did not, and I can't remember which was which, but the Eastern Church did not accept either Hebrews, probably Hebrews they didn't accept, and the Western Church didn't accept the Revelations. And so, but by 340, the Codex something, I forget, had the entire list, and by 367 we have a more well-documented list of all the books that we now have, the 27 books or letters that we have, epistles that we have there in our New Testament. So that was when they had them. But that, if you think about that, that was pretty far into this history of the church, and that many false teachers had come before that. Okay, so we're going to give a little more attention here to these persecutions that I spoke of earlier. And I'm a little unsure of how much to talk about this. I could just say there were persecutions and move on. But I thought I'd do just a little bit of explaining. In July of 64, Emperor Nero, for some reason, and I've read the reason, I can't quite remember, but I think it was some book he'd read or a book or whatever he'd read, and decided it was a fantasy in his mind. He set Rome on fire. He basically burned the city down. He was the emperor there, and he burnt the thing down just to watch it burn, though, so they say. And he got this idea from somewhere else, but it was a fantasy that he had. Well, the problem was the other people weren't involved in that fantasy and didn't like it. I don't remember how many people died in that fire, but many of them did. And so to cover himself, he blamed it on the Christians, because guess what? They were the most unpopular people around. It wasn't they were atheists. They were immoral. They were these people there. And he could cover himself, so he blamed it on them. And he began to persecute them. That persecution was in and around Rome. It wasn't very widespread. It was mostly concentrated in the leaders, but it was horrible. I mean, the things the man did, we know it's ungodly, but it's horrible. He tied them up on posts for his lights in the dark to light his gardens, to set them on fire. Used them for torches. And many, many other things he did with them. Just tremendously terrible things that he did. But that was the persecution that I spoke of, that Peter and Paul were both killed. Paul was beheaded and Peter crucified. They would have been leaders there. Then later on, and I'm going to not go into these too much, but later on the emperor Domitian began to require his subjects to worship him as Lord and God. This would have been in the latter 80s. And because the Christians and Jews refused to do so, many were martyred. Timothy and Antipas were among these. If you remember Antipas, it talks in Revelation 2 or 3 there. It speaks of his faithful martyr Antipas. And they would have been killed in the persecution following that. It seems also probable that John, the Revelator, would have been sent to the Isle Patmos through this persecution. And so many again were killed there in that one. Trajan, early in the second century, this would have been, I forget, was it 125, somewhere around there, persecuted Christians who did not make the required offering to the emperor and their worship. According to the tradition, Onesimus died in this persecution. That would have been the slave, I think, that had run away from Philemon there, if I'm correct. But and you can correct me. Some of these names I might get mixed up, but because I didn't look them up, I'm just kind of going by memory. But according to tradition, he died there in that persecution. Marcus Aurelius, in his reign, persecuted Christians. He didn't seem to have a hatred for Christians. He didn't see them as bad people necessarily, but they just wouldn't obey the command to worship God, the gods of Rome. And this was the persecution which Justin Martyr would have died in. But so these were persecutions the early church faced. In between these persecutions, there was time of peace. There was one time there was at least 40 years of peace in between these. And there are more recorded, and there are probably many that have not been recorded. Usually, they were pretty local. Usually, they were just in a certain area. There were a few that were more widespread. But at the beginning of the 4th century, the 300s, under the Emperor Diocletian, there was an intense persecution. They called it the Great Persecution. The church had rest for 40 years. They were unprepared for this persecution. Many of them compromised, offered their incense to the emperor, but many later repented of that and came back again, and some of them were martyred. But this was a great persecution, and thousands were put to death in this persecution. And I'm going to read you just one. I don't think this was in Diocletian's. I think this might have been in Marcus's one. But I'm going to read this one. I told you, sisters, yesterday that about some of these girls that suffered. And I just want to read one here because I want to make a statement about it. But this was Blandina. I think this doesn't say here whether she was a slave. I think from some other source I had understood that she was a slave girl. But she was exceeding dreadfully tormented. And she was this young girl, and the others were very fearful that she would not be able to endure the pain and she would deny Christ. But she was so steadfast in all her sufferings that the hands of the executioners grew tired before her heart would faint. It is a cause of great astonishment. The executioners began early in the morning and continued tormenting her all day until evening, so that they were much surprised how it could be possible that life was not yet extinct in her. However, it's explained by this saying that as often as she repeated her confession, crying, "I am a Christian," her heart was strengthened, so that she was again enabled to endure the pain. And it goes on here, talks about some others that were being tormented with her. But then she was thrown in prison. They were taken out again the next day and they were tormented. And the mode of torture this time was many stripes. They were scourged a second and third time with all kinds of rods, as well as beaten with sticks, cudgels, and three-cornered and barbed splinters. And also pinched, cut, carved, and torn with all sorts of hooks, cutting knives, claws, pincers, and iron combs. This was what she endured. This was the second day of her torture. Or I don't know if it was consecutive days or later, but it was the second time. And then they stretched this, and the others they executed that time. But Blandina, they stretched out crosswise on a stake. In other words, they tied her this way and they set her in where the wild beasts were. But the wild beasts wouldn't touch her. And so she was taken away again. But afterwards, she was brought out again with another youth. And they were commanded to swear by the gods, and they refused to do that. And so so the youth was so terribly tormented that he died, and Blandina rejoiced because of the steadfastness of her departed youth. Now, remember, just think of this. I mean, this poor girl endured all that stuff, and she was rejoicing because he'd been faithful. She rejoiced so greatly in the steadfastness of the departed youth whom she adopted as her son, as well as in the death of her faithful friends who had already gone through the conflict, that being beaten by the tyrants, she leaped for joy. Touching her death, it is stated that she was roasted upon a gridiron and afterwards wounded in a net, thrown before bulls, which tossed her many a time high up in their horns and then let her fall down again. She, however, not being dead yet, the judge commanded her to be killed. And so I'll just read that to say this. You know, when we think about persecution, we tend to think about the pain and the way our flesh we just can't imagine that kind of thing. But again, I didn't do a very good job yesterday, and I don't think I can do much better today. But I would like to think about this. I would like to think that if you look at her, what she endured, and you compare that to the weakness of your flesh, you're not going to stand. But remember what she was saying. She said, "I am a Christian." Her focus was always Christ. And because of that, Christ gave her the grace. And I don't know how all that was. I don't know how much she felt. But the devil threw everything at her that he possibly could to prove to the world that Christ was not powerful enough to keep his people, his own, and he was unable to do that. And so she defeated death in that way. She defeated the devil. And I just like to hold that up as a thing. If we can keep our focus on Christ and allow Christ to worry about the rest. And it'd be a tremendously hard thing to do because we know the weakness of our flesh. And we can't even stand. You know, if you smash your fingernail, that's painful. But it seems God's grace is much more than sufficient. Okay. It pleased God to use the most unlikely person, this young girl, to prove to everyone that His grace was able to defeat everything that the devil could throw at her. So anyway, so we've come now from the lowly man Jesus through the apostles and disciples to a Christian world which endured not only persecution but combated wrong doctrine and established the New Testament canon, and through it all the church had continued to grow. Now there's a really radical shift about to take place, and we'll get started in this. We can't finish it. But little did the survivors of that great persecution know. Now we're at the year... We're at about 305, somewhere in there, early 300s, 30, yeah, somewhere in there. But little did the survivors of the great persecution know, no, this would have been a little later, probably about 8, 7 or 8, 9, somewhere in there. They did not know that in less than 2 years, their persecuted religion would go from a hated religion that empires had been trying to stamp out for years to religion not only protected, but also promoted by the government. It was as if the devil, after years of failing to defeat the witness of Christ, had suddenly switched tactics and decided to try flattery. And you can understand why so many of them felt like it was an answer from God, it was a tremendous blessing from God, because they had just been enduring this tremendous persecution where your life was in danger all the time. If you were a Christian, you were tortured and whatever else. And all of a sudden, you have this, first off, you have this edict of toleration, which Diocletian signed, or was it, did I say that right? It was Galerius, I think. One of those emperors, anyway. Just before he died, he signed the edict of toleration, which said, basically, that since the Christians could not be brought back to the gods, their ancestors, they should be permitted to worship their own God. I think that was Galerius that did that. But what had happened was Diocletian had stepped down. Galerius had taken the reins in the east. Constantinus had ruled in the west. And Galerius then continued the persecution until 311, when just before his death, he issued that edict of toleration. That gave them a reprieve there. In it, he had directed that they could worship their own gods. And Constantinus, which was the father of Constantine, died in 306, and then his son Constantine took over the reins of the government. So now we have this thing where Constantine is reigning. Licinius is in the east. Constantine's in the west. And there's still persecution going on at this time, a little bit, though that toleration edict has been signed. But there were five others seeking. So now we're going into the political part of this. So you have Constantine here, and he's just been, because of his dad's death, he is the emperor in the West. But there's five others trying to get his seat. So he's concerned more about that right now than he is about the Christians. And so he conquers most of these, except there's one. There's Maxentius is left, which has a greater army, more men than he does. And so he has this one to conquer yet before he's the only emperor in the West. And as he's going toward that battle, he sees this sign in the sky of this cross over the sun and the Latin words that say, "In this sign, conquer." And so most of you know that. You have heard enough about Constantine to have heard that part of his life. But then he dreamed that night, supposedly another dream that confirmed that. And so he went in that sign. So he took the cross as his flag, as his ensign, or whatever you want to call it, as his standard, and he went into battle and defeated this Maxentius at the Bridge of Milvon in 312, even though Maxentius had a much larger army than he did. And after this victory, he declared himself a Christian. Now, that was a Christian name only, but it did something to those persecuted people. Because in 312, Constantine in the west and Licinius in the east together issued the Edict of Milan. And I'll read that here. It read like this. This is probably not the entire, but it says this: "Our purpose is to grant to Christians and to all others full authority to follow whatever worship each person has desired, whereby whatsoever divinity dwells in heaven may be benevolent and propitious to us and to all who are under our authority. Therefore, we thought it helpful and most proper to establish our purpose that no person whatever should be refused complete toleration who has given up his mind either to the cult of the Christians or the religion he feels best suited to himself. It is our pleasure that every one of those who have a common wish to follow the religion of the Christians may from this moment freely and unconditionally proceed to observe the same without any annoyance or disquiet. So that's what, and the church, I mean, can you imagine? You're persecuted for 10 years or however long it was, and all of a sudden you have this thing that just turns the whole thing around. And you can understand why the church was ecstatic about that, and why Eusebius, if you ever read him, he just waxes on and on about how great this man Constantine was, and how he was sent from God, and how he was the messenger of God. So anyway, you can understand that a little bit. But so we're going to have to leave that there. And I'll just mention this real quick. Constantine then defeated Licinius and became the sole emperor of the empire. So we're going to leave that there with Constantine in control of the whole empire at this point, and the Christians have freedom. And tomorrow we'll take up from there. Thank you. God bless you.